Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. On this week's show, we'll be talking about Fakhar Zaman's extraordinary performance in a losing cause for Pakistan against South Africa at the Wanderers. The rest of that series, a bit on West Indies, Sri Lanka, Australia's world record ODI winning streak, Sarah Taylor's playing return, an interview with Sarah Taylor, some IPL stuff and a preview of the County Championship. I'm Yaz Rana and with me today is the features editor of Wisden.com, Tahar Hashim, former England batsman Mark Butcher and Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine editor Joe Harman. Lots to get through today. Tahar, let's start with that extraordinary innings from Fakhar Zaman. He hit 193 off 155 balls to nearly rescue Pakistan from 205 for 7 to their target of 342, with just Shaheen Afridi, Harris Ralph and Mohammad Hasnain for company. It's the highest ever ODI score in a run chase. He was a player of the match of the Champions Trophy final nearly 4 years ago now. He's played one of the all-time great ODI knocks this week, but it feels like he's not done a huge amount in between. An amazing innings from a very interesting cricketer.
Yeah, he's had a pretty quiet time late in international cricket. I think he's played just the one ODI last year. Pakistan haven't played too many ODIs since the last World Cup. Hasn't done much of note in T20Is. I think he was dropped earlier this year when South Africa toured Pakistan. But he is that man in that Pakistan batting lineup who you look to for them to boost themselves up to the 300 plus totals. His strike rate is just under 100. He's just a hell of a lot of fun to watch. He's that one guy you can see in that Pakistan lineup who sort of fits the modern template of what ODI batsmanship should be about. So him finding some form is pretty important for them. But yeah, you're right. It's been quite a few years from him. He had a bit of a run in the test side, did all right against Australia, but hasn't been seen in that format for 2 years. So when I saw that he hit 193, I thought, well, it's good to see him back.
Yeah, it was an amazing innings. And I know we're all desperate to talk about his run out at the end, but before we get to that, Butch, I feel that we're kind of seeing these kind of innings more often where you have an established batsman with a tail ender needing loads of runs at the end of the game. There was the Stoinis 146 a few years ago, the Pereira and Stokes test knocks, Sam Curran's 95 we talked about last week. Do you think we're seeing more of them? And if so, why do you think that's the case?
That's a good question. I mean, I have no idea is the answer, and that's why they pay me the big bucks. I wonder if it's simply because the modern player, generally, the guys that can handle themselves with the bat anyway, are capable of scoring at 10, 11, 12 and over by themselves. Back in the old days, you got down to that sort of position and the run rate was up around about 8, 9s or 10s. And I say old days, I mean sort of 10 years ago. And the established batsman didn't have the power to make all those runs by himself. So he had to rely on the other guy scoring a few, which gave the opposition the opportunity to try and knock him over. And maybe what's happened now is you've got guys who are more than capable of going at 15s by themselves, not having to worry about any sort of contribution at all from the other end. And, you know, being able to sustain that sort of striking over a longer periods of time. And I think that's basically what it boils down to. You know, that we mentioned the Sam Curran innings last week. You know, turning down all of those runs. You know, at the end shake-up, you might say, oh, well, for goodness sake, if you'd have just turned the strike over maybe once or twice more, you might have ended up winning the game. But on the other hand, you then give the opposition the chance to knock the other guy over, don't you? So, I mean, I think that's what it boils down to, really. And, you know, the fact that you also have a lot of run chases, lots of times you're chasing 300, also gives the scope for that sort of innings, doesn't it? You're not going to do that if you're only chasing 240, you know, the old 50-over score of 240, 230. You don't get the opportunity for a guy to come in and have to score that many. So there are lots of reasons why you're getting these sort of matches that never die. You know, they kind of get extended forever and ever. You thought it was all over. It is now, but it wasn't until then.
Yeah. Joe, I sometimes feel that fielding captains almost don't know what to do in those scenarios because the batsman basically backs himself to hit two boundaries, two sixes and over, whatever the field is, whatever the bowling's like. What do you think captains can do to stifle them? Because I think another thing that's interesting about those knocks I reeled off is that with the exception of Stokes, you wouldn't really call any of those guys like greats of the game. A lot of people, like Sam Curran, we were talking about last week, if even batting's his strongest suit. So what do you think fielding captains can do in those situations?
Oh, I'm not sure how well qualified I am to answer that one. I think part of the I laugh sometimes in T20 because you'll see a huddle with the captain and three other players and they'll debate for about a minute like where the fielders should be, and then they just launch them over the boundary. And this problem is not just boundary hitting, it's six hitting, isn't it? Six hitting is so many batsmen are capable of six hitting that fielding's placing has become almost irrelevant at times, especially when you've got a situation like Faka where he had license to do exactly whatever he wanted, so he could just try and hit sixes. So I'm not sure there is that much that opposing captains can do, really. You're very much in the hands of your bowler, and can he manage to not hit the slot too regularly? Because, you know, if he does, then he's disappearing out of the ground.
So you touched on a really important point there, I think. You know, the argument still rages. You still hear people say, well, it's all the bats, isn't it? You know, that's the only reason. Well, that's not. You know, there were guys capable of hitting the ball long distances, hitting huge sixes with the old planks, you know. Funnily enough, they had good bats back then too. You know, they just looked different. The difference is that everybody can now do it. You know, everyone can access the 30th row, whereas back in the old days, you'd have one guy in a team that could do that. And that makes captaining and bowling at the death so much more fraught with danger. You just cannot get away with anything. You know, bowlers trying deliberately to bowl wide, bowlers trying deliberately to take all the pace off the ball, bowl it halfway down the pitch on purpose, you know, trying anything they can to try and elicit a miss hit. And that's, you know, that's what makes, I think that's what makes the game so much better now than it used to be. I mean, I'm not one of those people that goes, oh, you know, I want the bowlers to have a bit more of a say. The bowlers have as much say now as they did then. You know, you end up taking two big wickets at the back end. Doesn't matter if you've gone at sevens or eights before then. It's the wicket taking. It might be one over that wins your team a game against some of the fiercest hitters of the ball that the game has ever seen. It's guys who all practice hitting the ball very long distances, who all have the ability to do it.
And conditioning
and strength training that goes right the way down the board. You know, I've got Viv over here to my left. You know, he could hit the ball miles, but now all modern batters now look and hit the ball like Viv, you know, whereas he was an outlier. That's the norm.
Yeah, T20 batsmen look noticeably different now, don't they? I mean, the size of their arms are enormous. Even someone like Joss Butler, who's not a big man, and he obviously times the ball better than almost anyone I've seen, but those arms are enormous.
Yeah, but
a lot of gym work.
You watch him. You watch himself and somebody like Kohli, the way that they prepare. They're not doing curls or anything like that. They are squatting vast quantities of weight. You know, throwing steel around at levels that is, you know, that cricket players never used to do. It's sort of rugby style training. It's all in the arse and in the quads and in the hamstrings, where all this power comes from. So it's not, you know, yes, the bats look better. Your trainers look different than they did in the 1980s. You know,
not
that's
really.
Yours don't. No, sorry, bad example. But, you know, that's that, of course, you know, there's an evolution in all of those things. But the thing that's changed the most is the way that the players are, not the way that the kit that they're using, which is still willow, still cane, still rubber and glue. It's still made out of the same stuff that Albert Trott was hitting it over the pavilion at Lord's.
Allegedly.
It's still the same stuff. You know, it's not like carbon fibre has replaced it as it is in tennis, or, you know, the way that golf equipment has evolved. It's the same stuff. But these guys are not the same stuff. They are very, very different.
And while it's a tougher job for bowlers, I mean, your sort of appreciation just grows for them more when they do make the breakthroughs now. So when you watch someone like Jofra Archer in the IPL, like, barely go for any in the power play against, you know, everyone bowling to is, you know, conditioned to taking it on the power play. You know, you just, it sort of leaves you in just a bit more awe, I guess.
And I guess, and also what you're saying there is how much more they're training specifically, not just in the gym, but technically to hit the sixes as well. We're based at the Oval, and last summer, Tara, I remember us talking about how much we were almost surprised at how much they were training for T20 cricket. I know it was a strange season last year, but the Surrey lot were training a lot more for the white ball stuff than they were for the red ball stuff. Which
it didn't show either, did it? in the championship, boy. Yeah. How bad.
Yeah. Anyway, but what is your moment of the week? It's been a very good series so far. The first game was a thriller, but your moment of the week was...
there's only one, isn't it? The run out of Fakhar, the innings, and then obviously the run out was just a magical, magical moment. Because, you know, long before the law change, what was it, 41.5.5?
Yeah, it is.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is.
That's pretty good. The Alex Stewart used to do it all the time. Stewie would sort of be standing, pretending that the ball was coming to him, and watch batsmen dive in from 10 yards and knowing that the ball wasn't going anywhere. So this was in reverse. It was always very funny, very, very amusing. I was victim of Paul Nixon fumbling a ball down the leg side, and part of the joy of that was that Nico used to fumble it a lot. You know, no disrespect, but he did. Fumbling a one down the leg side of a spinner and going, and then taking a couple of steps like he was going to chase after it. He'd actually gloved it. I took off to go, you know, to run the bye or whatever, and he whipped the bails off, out, stumped. And all of that was legal. I was very unimpressed. but, you know, you were allowed to do that sort of thing now. But with Quentin de Kock, it was, I mean, you know, the way that they all laughed and he was absolutely peeing himself at the end just tells you all you need to know about the fact that he, you know, he took a bit of a punt and, you know, it paid off and he didn't get the 5-run penalty and Fakhar was given out. Yeah. Nobody can tell me that was not illegal, and that Fakhar should have still been there to attempt to pull off the impossible with that run chase.
Yeah, so
and therefore, brilliant banter moment.
Sort of
week.
It was definitely very funny. Just in case our listeners aren't aware of law 41.5, the fake fielding law, it states that it is unfair for any fielder to willfully attempt by word or action to distract, deceive or obstruct either batsman after the striker has received the ball. According to clause 41.5.2, it is for either one of the umpires to decide whether any distraction, deception or obstruction is willful or not. You said you're not going to have anyone telling you that it wasn't deliberate. I think there is a small chance that de Kock was genuinely trying to tell Ngidi to get to the stumps, that he was going to take the ball and he's going to throw it straight away. And I think there is a slight problem in the law in that it is very hard to work out if it was deliberate from the fielder.
Didn't Bavuma inadvertently acknowledge in the post-match press conference that it was deliberate, though?
Listen, if you've played the game, if you've been on the field and you see the reaction of everybody after it happens, you know, you 100% know it just from their reaction that they'd pulled a fast one, and everybody knew it. Yeah. Especially Quentin de Kock. I mean, you know, Fakhar at the end has sort of said, I was worried about the non-stick. It actually doesn't matter. I mean, the reason that the law was changed in the first place was because a fielder's, you know, sliding. So if you knock one out towards the boundary and whatever, and there's a fielder running backwards towards the ball and to the fence, and another fielder running around to come and pick it up, the fielder running back towards the fence slides and pretends to pick the ball up and throw. And the batter's running between the wickets will catch that out of the corner of the eye, thinking that he's picked it up and is throwing it back in. And therefore, you create that sort of, you know, that split second hesitation. It might save you a run. It might even cause you a run out. And so that's the reason that they changed the law. And, anything that happened up until the law changed, fine, all's fair in love and war, a bit of shithousery, beep, you know, whatever you want to call it. But now that there's a law that covers it, illegal, should have been cancelled. But and because of that, that's what makes it brilliant, because everyone is going to argue about it forever. So it's one of those.
It's a hard one for it's a hard one for the umpires to pick up at the time, isn't it? So how should it have been? Are we expecting the umpires to have picked up on it, or should there have been a check upstairs? How should we have got to the right decision?
Well, I mean, I've seen it once, right? I saw it once, and immediately I kind of knew what was going on, having not heard anything about what was happening beforehand. Because I was following the game on Twitter, I wasn't seeing it on the TV, so I then went and had a look on the television. Just went, oh my god, how's he got away with that? You know, and the umpire, I don't know.
The so it should be the square leg umpire.
They might be looking at sort of, you know, guys touching in, or you know, it would have been the guy at square leg, wouldn't it? And how he hasn't picked up on what has gone on there, I have no idea.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, in the heat of the moment, it's not like the the World Cup fiasco, where apparently the law says that the batsmen need to have crossed before a deflection can count for four runs in the, you know, when Stokes deflected the ball. Nobody knows that law. And quite
ben
frankly,
Gardner probably did.
How do you police that? I mean, it's a nonsense. It's a terrible, terrible law. Another reason why New Zealand feel hard done by.
Mm. And there's been a bit of confusion about what the party line is from South Africa. Because obviously,
Bavuma
said after the game that it was really clever from de Kock, sort of hinting at the fact that it was a deliberate move. And then the next day, Tabrik Shamsi's on Twitter saying de Kock was just communicating with his teammate at the non-striker zone or something. So they're sort of changing their tune a bit, I think. Also, great throw.
yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, not really being talked about much, but yeah, it was a really good throw. But it's been a really good series so far. It's a shame that some of the South African players are leaving, something you've got a bit of flack for on Twitter.
I'm sorry about that. I mean, not only have I got the job as a South African coach and head of cricket without my knowledge, I also look after Rhino in my spare time. So, sorry, Butch, not Bouch.
But it's been a really good series so far. There was 100 from Rassie van der Zusen in his first international cricket in the first game. A game won by Pakistan off the last ball. But one player that's really impressed me this series is Anrik Nokia. He's been really, really good so far. He got 7 wickets across the 2 games, all of which have been top order batsmen. He leaves the country before the final game of the series to join up with the Delhi Capitals. He now averages under 20 with the ball in ODI cricket. He's very good. In the Caribbean, the West Indies-Sri Lanka series was a drawn 0-0 series, a stalemate. You don't get many of those anymore, but you're wondering when the last one was. Before I tell you guys, can you guess?
I mean, New Zealand-England had one, but that was quite a long time ago.
So
Ashes 29. Oh, no, it's not a drawn series, though, is it? No wins.
So the New Zealand 0-England 0 in 2013 was the last time you had a 0-0 series not involving Bangladesh before this one.
Really?
So you're pretty close.
Wow, I knew it was a rarity, yeah.
The last one was South Africa-Bangladesh in 2015, but that doesn't even really count because that took place in the monsoon series in the season and only 3 days of cricket were possible across the series. and there were a couple of others in Bangladesh around that time, but yeah. And there was another record broken in the second test match. Craig Brathwaite broke the West Indies record for the most minutes batted in a test match by a West Indian batsman. 813 minutes. He scored 126 in the first innings and 85 in the second. A decent win to West Indies. 4 tests without defeat now in a row. Moving on to another record, this time a world record. Australia women have now won 22 ODIs in a row, a record that's across both men's and women's cricket. They last lost an ODI in October 2017. Taha, it's an incredible achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was just looking at some of the sort of individual performances in there. I mean, Alyssa Healy's record since the start of 2018 is just a joke. So 22 ODIs, averaging 57 at a strike rate of 107.93. So Elise Perry in that same period, I think, averages more, but a strike rate of 75. Like, that's just ridiculous. And yeah, just an astonishing achievement. But I don't want to sound like a total killjoy.
You're going to, though, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Everything before the butt is nonsense.
And this is nothing to do with the Australian team and what they've been doing, but it's just watching the record being broken just brought to my mind the interview Charlotte Edwards did with Crick Info a few weeks ago, and talking about one of her concerns, which is sort of, this is what she said, that the standard of international cricket is a massive concern. There are 2 or 3 teams that are really going away from the pack at the moment. And so that really sums up my state of mind. That's the first thing that came to mind when I saw Australia break the record.
Well, but they've played England quite a bit in that as well.
Yeah, that's true.
They've played the teams that would count as the top three themselves. England, New Zealand. Well, I mean, South Africa are making a bit of a bid.
Yeah, but I guess the worry is that, you know, a year ago Australia were playing India in that final, and what's happened with India since, and sort of the lack of help in getting the Indian women's side any games is that's the real.
I mean, it should be said, New Zealand did manage to beat Australia in a T20 a few days before. I mean, you'd hope these things do happen, but they do lose the odd T20 game, even if they don't lose. Yeah. I mean, too many ODIs.
The issue is professionalism, isn't it? Is kind of like just how different the resources and the talent pool, all the rest of it, are in two or three countries compared to everywhere else, and that's the problem. That's not Australia's fault, but it does kind of lead to slight disparities. But I still think it's an extraordinary record. 22 games on the bounce. That takes some doing.
Joe, do you think that the gap between Australia and the rest is closing at all, or is it growing larger and larger?
I know Australia have beaten England reasonably comfortably recently, but I don't think the gap is huge there. I think it's a couple of players different. I think that the depth in Australian cricket is obviously much, much better than English cricket at the moment. But I think that will change. I think that will start to change this summer with the 41 new professional contracts, with the women's 100, which, whatever you say about the 100, the women's 100 has got to be a great thing for women's cricket in this country. And you start to see a few more names. Izzy Westbury wrote about this in her column for the latest magazine. We're starting to see a couple more different names in that England side, which hasn't really happened for quite a long time. Got people like Freya Davis coming through, whereas it's just been Brunt and Trubsall for a decade, really. Partly because they're brilliant, but also partly because they haven't really had that pressure from underneath. So I think in 5 years' time, we might well have a situation where Australia and England are way too far ahead of the rest for it to be a competitive overall landscape. And I think India are the ones that can do something about that by actually prioritising women's cricket. They've made lots of good noises, but they haven't really put their money where their mouth is in that regard.
I mean, other than their announcement by the secretary of the BCCI, Jay Shah, his tweet on International Women's Day announcing that there'll be a test match between England and India later this year. I think that took the ECB by surprise. And I think other than that, they haven't been...
That wasn't a there will be. That is there will be. We're telling you.
Yeah, the kind of vibe of it was kind of like, oh, probably should do something today. And tweet it from his personal account. Anyway, the big news this morning on Tuesday is that Sarah Taylor is returning to top-tier professional cricket. She'll be playing alongside Meg Lanning for the Welsh Fire in the inaugural edition of the 100. It's obviously wonderful news. I spoke to her earlier this week about her return to the game and also her recent experience being part of the Sussex men's coaching setup. Here is that chat. Well, first off, Sarah, great to have you back playing. So how did the decision to return come about, and how long have you been mulling it over?
I'd love to say my first hit was end of January. I really can't remember. I think there was loads of things that happened in my life to kind of be put in place in order to be okay and feel completely comfortable about accepting this decision. Where am I anxiety-wise? Where am I? Am I grounded? Am I all these things? And I had to tick a lot of boxes. Not forced, obviously. It's not been forced. It's been a gradual kind of succession, really, of all those things to be ticked off. So, I did have an offer last year by Welsh Fire, actually. Well done from them. The offer was there, but I wasn't in a place to play at all. And I said that, and I was very honest with him. And I said that to Motti. Yeah, I'm not in a place, but by all means, think about me next year and see what happens. So he did, and he asked. And and like I say, I was in a much better place. I'd had the hit. I felt good. I'm not scared of cricket anymore. And I know that sounds a little bit bizarre, but I'm kind of up for the fight and up for the challenge now, rather than kind of shying away from it, which I think I got to. That was the place I was at towards the end of my career. So international career, I'm still going. So I'm just happy about being back, and hopefully it'll be good fun.
So what prompted you to have that hit? Because it sounded like you hadn't played for quite a long time. So why did you pick up the bat?
I missed it. And I never thought I'd say that. I did miss it. You know, I'm coaching at a school. I'm clawing all day. I'm working with wicketkeepers. And at some point I was like, well, why are they having all the fun? I might give this a go. Again, dusted my bag, like the cobwebs off. And then all of a sudden I thought, right, okay, just give it a go. I've got nothing to lose here. If I'm terrible, what does it matter? If I do all right, well, let's consider things. And it was a case of I did all right. And I was like, do you know what? Actually, I've not lost it at all. And then, yeah, the offers were there. And then it was quite a simple decision from then. But yeah, it's been an interesting journey the last couple of months, kind of trying to get back to think about what I need for a cricket match, like keeping socks. Who knew that I needed to get keeping socks again? So yeah, it's been good fun, kind of getting back into that headspace of playing cricket again.
Mm. There's been a lot of noise about the 100 for a few years now. As a player who is now going to be involved, how excited are you to be playing alongside and against some of the very best players in the world?
I mean, that's obviously a draw. That's a draw to play in it. You want to challenge yourself against the best. And you also want to have three of the best Australian players on your team, which is very nice. But yeah, look, it's a draw for me, a draw for players, and it's a draw for everyone watching, isn't it? What is it, eight teams, seven cities, isn't it? Yeah, seven cities. So it's just so nice for that to be a part of it, really. I mean, look, it's easily accessible, isn't it, for everyone going. I hope we can get crowds. I would absolutely love if we can get crowds back. That's the dream, isn't it? Mainly because if I am on the boundary, I can actually sign things now. I couldn't do that before when I was right next to the wicket. So it would just be nice to, yeah, play in front of a crowd, play in front of, in a new tournament, new face, kind of new kit, new names. Hopefully it's good. Hopefully it'll be a massive success.
Mm. You talked a lot about your coaching and how you're enjoying it and the satisfaction you get from it. How have you found it with working with the Sussex men's first team?
Oh, amazing. I'm learning every single day. At the Oval yesterday, just walking around the boundary with James Kirtley, who's got hundreds of wickets, first-class cricket. Ian Saul, like Saul speaks for himself, doesn't he? England, Sussex, Surrey. He's an unbelievable player. So just learning off of them, and it's nothing to do with keeping. I was even, Alex Stewart was out working with Folksy. I don't even think I watched any part of the game. I was watching that, just seeing what they were doing. It's just, I couldn't be in a better position to learn the art of coaching. Ian Salisbury talks very much about, they're not going to remember, I think I'm going to quote him now, he'll love this. I'm pretty sure he said, they're not going to remember it if you teach them a cover drive, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And I'm a massive believer in that. And I love the ethos that they've got there at Sussex. So yeah, love being a part of it. Brownie is an absolute angel to work with. He's all about enjoyment, which is perfect for me. I couldn't think of being anywhere else at all.
There aren't many women coaching in professionals, men's sport, let alone cricket. Do you feel like a trailblazer?
No, because I feel like one of the lads. That kind of word keeps getting thrown around. I don't feel like one, but I'm hoping. I really hope I'm not the last one, the last female to be a part of as a coach, as a part of the staff of a men's team. So, I think in Australia it is about Julia Price, I think, was part of a men's team, but I think keeping lends itself a little bit easier to kind of go in that role. But I don't see why, in terms of cricket knowledge in the game itself, I don't see why more females can't be part of the coaching staff in men's teams. And I will happily 100% push for that.
Amelie Moresbo, who coached Andy Murray for a little bit, said that when she first got into coaching in men's tennis, that she felt like she had to do a little bit more to be respected. And it wasn't quite as easy for her because she's a woman. What would you say to other women in cricket who might be thinking about coaching men's cricket and might be a bit hesitant going into that, having heard other women's experience in the past?
Look, I think you've got to back your skills and back what you're about. I think you have to be 100% true to yourself. I'm very much someone that likes to enjoy my coaching. I like the person that I am coaching to really throw themselves into what we're doing. I did learn that, you know, you get one little nugget into a player's head, and then they're kind of with you on that journey. They're all of a sudden there. So, and I don't think that is a men's thing. I think that's any player that you work with. So, yeah, I was really, really lucky that Brownie took to me very quickly. I've known him since I was 14. Wow, that's a while back now. So, and we were on the academy together, so we're exactly the same age. So it's a little bit of a weird dynamic, but yeah, he could see what I had to offer, and he was quite open with that. But I would genuinely say to any woman that is considering those options to 100% back yourself. You have to trust that you are good enough, and not believe kind of any of the hype that women aren't, because we are. And I've had the experiences to back that up. I know where. I'm not ashamed to say that I've got areas to work on, and I will push myself on those. And that's why I'm trying to learn as much as possible from other coaches. So, yeah, I would say 100% back yourself.
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was a viciously turning leg break from an Australian spinner who England might possibly be seeing a bit of later this year. This is Mitchell Swepson, who we've talked about on the show maybe a few months back. He had a brilliant start to the Sheffield Shield season, and then had a stress fracture in his neck, which sounds a nasty injury. Yeah, so he's meant to be out for the rest of the season, but has come back quicker than expected. Returned for Queensland's most recent match against New South Wales, who are likely to be the two finalists. He took a couple of wickets, was a bit expensive in the first innings, but took 4 for 60 in the second innings. But it was one ball in particular, bowling round the wicket to left-handed Daniel Hughes, tossed it kind of well wide of off stump. If it continued on its trajectory, it would have probably been a wide in a one-day match. That's how wide it was. Turns viciously out of the rough and ends up knocking back his leg stump. So it's come back a hell of a long way. And Swepson said himself afterwards he felt like it was a half tracker when he let go of it, but it was considerably better than that. And then actually Daniel Brettig of Crick Info compared it to Warne getting Shanderpool at the SCG in 1996. They went back and looked at that footage, and there is definite similarities there. Swepson's now taken 29 wickets at 22 in the Sheffield Shield. And it's starting to become quite an interesting selection dilemma there for Australia, because I mean you can't doubt Lyon's record, but he didn't have a good series against India. A couple of fifth days that didn't go his way. It should be said, Lyon took 6 wickets in this match and was named player of the match, so it's not like he's a busted flush. But Brettig again said that that's the sort of thing that Lyon, for all his virtues, just can't offer after Swepson bowled that delivery. And you do see that. And it's interesting with that Australian attack. How do you balance it? Because you've got such a good pace attack. Does that give you the luxury of throwing in a leg spinner who can just produce those deliveries? Or do you think you need to maximise those pace bowlers? So you need a steady bowler like Lyon, who's just going to eat up overs and won't go for too many.
If they have a fourth seam bowling option in Green, then you might say, okay, we might be able to throw in a guy who can leak a little bit.
Hmm.
But you know, a four-man, the traditional Australian four-man pace attack is based around a spin bowler being able to hold as well as take lots of wickets.
Yeah,
because you have to give Hazelwood, Stark, and Cummins a rest. You know, you have to be able to hold an end down while those guys rotate. Otherwise, you need the fourth bowler, the fourth seamer. So, I would imagine that Lyon's got a little bit of time left in him just yet.
And he does pretty well against England in Australia as well.
Well, so exactly. He's a stunningly good bowler on pitches where finger spinners have really found life difficult. You know, the overspin and the control of length and flight that he has meant that he's, you know, and he does those things. You know, he'll bowl you out in the final 2 days of a test match, and he'll go for none, you know, or he'll take wickets forcing batsmen to try and have a go at them by being accurate and over the first 3 days. So, you know, unless if he breaks a finger, then great. I mean, it'd be brilliant to see a hard spinning leggy in an Australian side again. won't it? Sort of.
Yeah. Careful what you wish for. But also, Swepson's only 27, Lyons 33. So whether it's this winter or it's further down the line, it is starting to look like this guy might be the future, which is great for leg spin bowling because we see stacks of them in T20 cricket. Every good side's got one or possibly even two. But there aren't many leg spinners around in Test cricket. Obviously, you've got Rashid Khan for Afghanistan, but he's Yasir Shah, that's true. But there aren't many about.
Yeah.
And the few that do play often have a challenging time. So it'd be fascinating to see how he goes.
One thing that is interesting about someone like Swepson doing so well recently is that, I know we talked about this before in the podcast, but Australia don't have any Test cricket before the Ashes. I think they might have one Test against Afghanistan at home. England have seven Test matches, so there's plenty of time for England to chop and change. And I'm not saying having seven Test matches against the best two teams in the world, according to the ICC rankings, is necessarily a great thing. Could cause more problems than it solves. But it does mean Australia don't really have time to try things out in Test cricket before the first Test of that series.
Yeah, which probably doesn't count in Swepson's favour. I think he'll be in a squad. Lyon will be the first choice spinner. But who knows, if the first Test doesn't go Lyon's way, if Australia lost the first Test, then suddenly the clamour is going to start for a leg spinner who turns it like that. And also, I mean, we've seen England against the turning ball this winter. It doesn't always look pretty.
Yeah.
Could they end up preparing an Ahmedabad patch and playing two of them? Probably not.
You see the uproar of that in Australia. Oh, my God.
Well, since Lyon made his Test debut, I don't think Australia have played a wrist spinner in Test cricket.
Yeah,
I think that sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at least he comes into the equation.
Linus Labuschagne.
Right, of course, yeah, that's true.
He wasn't around at the start, wasn't he?
I think we might be getting a little bit too far ahead of ourselves if we're imagining England going 1-0 up and then throwing everything out the air. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm going to go with my moment of the week next. This is an interview on cricket.com.au with Ricky Ponting about Prithvi Shaw, specifically about his training habits in last year's IPL. In case you need reminding, Shaw was a bit out of nick and was eventually left out the Delhi side that Ponting coaches. So this is what Ponting said about coaching Shaw. He had an interesting theory on his batting last year. When he's not scoring runs, he won't bat. And when he is scoring runs, he wants to keep batting all the time. He had four or five games where he made under 10. And I'm telling him, we have to go to the nets and work out what's wrong. And he looked me in the eye and said, no, I'm not batting today. I couldn't really work that out. He might have changed. I know he's done a lot of work over the last few months. That theory he had might have changed, and hopefully it has, because if we can get the best out of him, he could be a superstar. I was going pretty hard at him. I was basically telling him, mate, you've got to get in the nets. Whatever you think you're working on, it's not working for you. It's my job as a coach to challenge someone's preparation if they're not getting results. So I challenged him, and he stuck to his word, and he didn't practice much at all towards the back end of the tournament, and he didn't get many runs towards the back end of the tournament either.
I also didn't pick him.
Since then, Shaw averaged 165 with a strike rate of 138 in the recent Vijay Hazare Trophy, the 50-over competition in India. So whatever he's done since has done the trick. But have you ever come across a player who's had a similarly weird approach to training?
Marcus Trescothick wouldn't bat on batting days. I mean, he would practice, obviously, in the lead up to a test match. But so obviously you don't know if you're batting or bowling on day one. But during the course of that test match, knowing that he was going to be batting that day, he wouldn't hit the ball. He'd go out and take a few slip catches, do a warm up and whatever, and then go and sit down. But other than that, I can't see people. I can remember people sort of trying to step away from practicing, or just disappear away from the game for a little while. But to have that as your tried and trusted method of things not going very well, okay, I'm never batting again. That could last forever. that's it. You never picked up another bat. So when do you decide? How many bad scores does it take before you actually decide, I might actually have to do a bit of batting here?
Would you have had the self-confidence at 21 to say to someone to of the Ponting. Stature of Ricky Ponting, no, I'll do it my way, thanks?
No, I mean, that's another thing, isn't it? This sort of...
That's someone who's been brought up being told that he's a seriously good player, right?
Also, yes. Ricky Ponting.
There's not a lot of accountability or he doesn't take much... Doesn't take much persuading from anybody. He is the business, and he will tell you so.
Didn't he wear 100 on the back of his shirt at the Under-19 World Cup?
I think so. I'm trying to imagine if you're Ricky Ponting in that situation, you're probably not used to young players disagreeing with you much, especially when they're not getting any runs and just being told throughout, no, I'm not going to bat actually.
Was it a video interview or was it written?
I've only seen it
written. I'd be interested to see what Ricky Ponting looked like, as you were saying. But it felt like there was some heavy inverted commas over interesting theory, didn't it, at the start?
That is a very fair point.
Ponting would have been spewing. I'd know him pretty well, you know, and everything was about sort of, you know, work ethic, work hard, you know, you don't work less, you work harder. So I can imagine that when the time came for him to drop the axe on the young man, he wasn't shedding too many tears about it. Right, that's your idea, you're gone.
I think Owen Morgan's talked about not facing that many balls when he's in a bad trot because it doesn't help him. But then that's something, he wasn't saying he did that at 21. He said that he's worked out over the course of his career, that's what works for him at different points. That's very different to being, I'm 21, I know exactly the best thing to do, which, you know, he's obviously a player. I mean,
you know nothing at 21. unless you're Sachin, I suppose. But I reckon he would have had a bat, don't you think?
Yeah. That's definitely true. Before we move on to the rest of the show, as mentioned in the pod last week, we've teamed up with Who Knows Wins for the IPL. Who Knows Wins is a social prediction app pitting yourself against your friends and colleagues for the chance to win a prize pot. We've set up an IPL by Wisden League that will be running weekly across the tournament this week. It starts with Mumbai Indians versus RCB, and it will run across the first 6 fixtures of the tournament. All you have to do is for each game predict who you think is going to win, and this week you need to predict who will score the most sixes in the match. That is the team that will score the most sixes, not the individual player, in order to gain points and have the chance of winning a prize pot. Download the Who Knows Wins app and head to the cricket homepage to find the IPL by Wisden League. Once you're in the league, you're able to invite your friends to take part. The more people playing, the bigger the prize pot. Myself, Joe, Phil and Ben are taking part. Joe, who have you gone for in the first game between Mumbai and RCB?
Call me contrary, but I've gone for RCB. Mumbai Indians lost their opening match last year, albeit they went 9 unbeaten after that. But I'm anticipating another early shock for the Indians. And you look at the RCB lineup, they've got Glenn Maxwell, AB de Villiers, Finn Allen, the big hitting Kiwi, might get a game. Dan Christian, who loves hitting a 6, might get a game. So there's plenty of 6 hitters there. So I'm going RCB to win and RCB to have the most 6 hitters.
Cool. So I've gone Mumbai for both, but I can see where you're coming from. I think on last week's show, we kind of assumed Mumbai win the whole thing. And I'm not quite sure that's definitely the case. I think their bowling attack might not be quite as good as we and other people have made out so far. But I am still going Mumbai. They are just very good at winning games of cricket.
They are very good at that.
And they've got players who are fresh from the England India series as well. A lot of them played in that. So I'm going Mumbai for both. Anyway, the county championship, as hard as it might be to believe, given it's currently 1 degree Celsius outside, that actually begins this week. On last week's show, Butch, you laughed at my prediction that Kent might win it.
Openly laughed
in my face. Joe, we'll start with you.
sorry, I did it again.
Joe, let's start with you. Who do you think are going to win the thing?
I think for about the last 6 years, I've backed Somerset, so I've decided to give the poor blokes a break. And to be honest, if I was putting some money on it, I would probably go for Essex. I just think they just win in difficult situations where it doesn't look like they should, and that counts for a lot. But I do think, looking at Yorkshire's squad, I think it looks really strong this year. I think it looks the best it has done since they last won the championship. Signing of Don Best is an interesting one. I don't think he's going to play Test cricket this summer unless he takes a lot of wickets, maybe towards the back end if he has a good season. So you'd think they'll get a lot out of him. That pace attack, Ben Code, just takes loads of wickets every year. Plenty of cricket in April. Same for Steve Patterson. And then you've got Dwayne Oliphair, who's got a bit of pace about him. So that's quite a nice balanced attack, those four there. And in the batting, you've got, I think, Gary Balance is back after missing last year through stress-related illness. You've got Johnny Bairstow, I think he's going to play a fair amount of red ball cricket. I don't see him playing Test cricket either.
Mm. And he's got the IPL though, I guess.
He has.
But when he comes back,
there's still a decent chunk there. And the same for David Malan when he comes back from the IPL. So those three are three batsmen who always score runs in county cricket when they play, really. And there aren't many batting units. There's loads of great bowling attacks around the country, or loads of very effective bowling attacks. There aren't that many batting lineups you think can kind of regularly post 300 plus. And I think Yorkshire at their strongest will, but you're right, Bairstow Milan away for a while is they might find themselves in a position after 4 weeks where they're almost out of the race, but they need a couple of batsmen like Adam Lythe, Tom Cowley-Cavmore. There's talented batsmen there, so I think they might be in amongst it.
What one thing that I'll admit I didn't take into consideration when I did my prediction for the magazine is how the new format might affect it and the fixture split. So just to run through it, there are three groups of six, and the top two from each group go into Division One. The winner of that Division One wins the championship, and there's a five-day final at Lords with the Bob Willis Trophy. But you could have some teams, and Yorkshire possibly fall in this category with Root in particular, where you have really good availability the first bit of the season, which is the group phase. You get into Division One, and you might not have those test players for much or any of the actual Division One. So I did predict Kent, kind of thinking, oh, Crawley's going to play loads, but actually he's not going to play
the
that much.
Master.
If any, yeah.
Exactly. Well, I probably should have mentioned Joe Root when I was talking about Yorkshire's good batsman. He's quite good, isn't he?
He's quite good,
but
yeah.
You have, so Joe Root will be there to start with, then he will obviously go and play test cricket, but then you could potentially have Bairstow Milan coming in. So there's quite a nice balance there.
Dar, what do you think?
It's a pretty boring call, but I just don't see any reason as to why Essex can't win it again. We're talking about availability, international call-ups. Essex don't really have that issue. You know, they don't have guys at the IPL. They've got the best batsman in the country who doesn't play international cricket anymore, Alistair Cook.
Best off-spinner in the world, according to him.
Yeah, yeah.
Not far off, though.
Yeah, they've got a phenomenal attack. I reckon Tom Wesley surely has a few more runs in him this year after struggling a bit last year. My dark horses are Kent. I do like the look of their batting lineup when Crawley's there. I also quite enjoy the romance of Darren Stevens winning the whole thing. But it's Essex for me, yeah.
Butch, what do you reckon?
Well, I'm struggling to nail down a winner. I mean, Essex do put together a pretty compelling case. However, I know from experience that winning 3 out of 3 on the bounce is some feat. You know, it hasn't been done. When was the last time it was done? Was it Yorkshire in the 60s or something?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, you know, that takes some doing in itself. So I've basically gone, I've got a bit of a wild card. I've got my top two from each of the groups, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the groups. Right, sorry, I've been trying to get my head around this for ages and it still hasn't quite gone in yet. But I've got Essex and Notts. Notts, who haven't won a four-day game since 2018, to go through from Group 1.
But they've got a good side, haven't
they? They've got a good side, yeah. And I'm looking at the rest of the group and sort of thinking, well, surely, you know. Group 2, I've gone for Somerset and Surrey. I mean, Somerset, well, they've been runners-up 5 out of the last 6 in the championship.
All the years I pick him, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, and they've still never won it, have they?
Yeah, never won it.
Never won it.
So they'll come second in their group.
Yeah, I mean, if there's any justice in the world, yeah, they'll come second in the whole thing. No, which means, you know, so I've gone for Somerset and Surrey. I think Surrey, Kemal Roach is a really exciting signing for them at the beginning of the season. They'll see quite a bit of the likes of Ollie Pope. You know, run scoring has been a bit of an issue for them, so it'd be good for them to have him about. Rory Burns has probably got a point to prove as well. You know, he's not guaranteed. I don't think he's guaranteed to sort of to be in the top order for come the test matches.
We'll get into that in a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's right. I had no idea, but there we go. So you know, so he's got a point. So there should be runs there, and obviously, Amar Singh Verdi with this sort of pushing. You know, anybody that hasn't played test match cricket who can bowl spin half decently is pushing, aren't they? I mean, let's face it. So, you know, they Somerset and Surrey, and then Group 3, Yorkshire and Kent. I mean, it just burst out. I couldn't help myself. But, yeah, Yorkshire looked to be by far the strongest team in Group 3 and might, you know, they might have a chance of running away with the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I think Kent are certain to go through to Division One, so I've sat on the fence simply because because the championship is too difficult a thing to win to sort of just to throw it out there. Oh, Essex are going to win 3 out of 3. Yeah, they could, and yeah, they probably should, but will they? I don't know.
One team I'll add in that we've not mentioned so far: Hampshire.
Yeah, I was going to say the same. Decent new ball attack.
Yeah, Abbott and Abbas is a pretty handy ball pair, and then Vince Northeast. They'll
Keith Barker as well, haven't they? Has he been?
Yeah, they've still got Barker.
He was there last year, but was injured for quite a chunk of it. Yeah,
Liam Dawson back will be back from injury. Mm. Well, it's a pretty good
Mason
side.
Crane,
yeah,
as well. So I was going to come into in a bit.
So it's a good side and possibly the weakest group as well. Maybe that group one as well. Lancashire and Sussex in group three can make things interesting. But yeah, I think it's all to play for. Obviously, we've got a few questions. One's from Sam Dawling related to what you just said a few moments ago, Butch. Do you think these first few rounds of the county championship could push new names into England contention, or is that unrealistic? If someone like Tom Lambie scores heavily, can they force their way in, or will it be two of the last squad opening the batting regardless? What do you think?
I think Sibley is for sure, and I think Crawley's spot for me is number three. I think I see him there in time stretching forward, and I don't have any issue with those two players at all. Rory Burns, I mean, it wasn't so long ago that he, you know, averaged almost 40 against that Australian attack here at home, and it looked like he'd made a massive breakthrough. And that the injury that he had in Johannesburg in the build-up to the South Africa, well, it was between the first and second Test matches, wasn't it, in South Africa, kind of, you know, put him under the skids and has put him under a bit of pressure. And you know, being that he plays the way that he plays, you kind of all it takes is for a few low scores, and everyone's kind of on his back and saying he shouldn't be in the side. So, look, the selectors might see it completely differently. They might back him to the hilt, and he'll be back in the side again, having been left out in India. But I think there's room there for there's always room for an improvement in your top three, isn't there? Particularly given the way that England sort of middle order likes to play. So yeah, I mean, somebody like Lamaby, Hamid, can he make good on the promise of, what was it, 2016? You know, he's part of the reason why I thought Notts might be a good bet for going through in Group One. And so there are one or two guys. Nick Gubbins, can have a good year for Middlesex. He's another guy who I think has got sort of like the at least the technique, perhaps, to make a go of it at the top level. So it's for sure one place out of three is up for grabs, I think.
On Hamid, given the struggles he's had, do you think England selectors will look at him, even if he said reeled off 200 or 300s in the first few weeks? Do you think England selectors would be sensible to think he needs a full season of this before we rush him back? Or do you think, because of what he did in India, when he just looked like a test batsman, they're going to be more inclined to bring him back in?
I don't know. I mean, look, we're starting the championship before the 10th of April again. Weather's horrendous. You know, you could have... If the bowlers end up being on top everywhere, and one batsman goes out there and makes 300 or 400s in challenging conditions, you'd say, well, hang on, you'd have to take notice of that, wouldn't you? You'd have to. And you're right. I think there is a little bit of credit in the bank. I mean, it's distant. It's dim and distant. But he certainly, as you said, I watched him then, and I'd watched him play in England under-19 cricket beforehand, and just thought he's just so much better than everybody else at his age at playing the way that he plays, you know. Great idea of where his off stump is, leaves the ball play straight, etc. So look, I'm a fan, but he has to prove it beyond reasonable doubt, I think.
Ty, you're a fan of Lamaby. I know a lot of people are, but you really are a big fan of Lamaby.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of interested to see what he can do over the course of a full season. So last year was sort of his first proper season with Somerset's first team, and you know, 300s on the bounce, one against Essex at Lords. Like, he looks a special player.
He's already got one this season as well in the warm-up games.
Yeah, that's right. And he's kind of, if the ECB were in a lab trying to create the perfect cricketer for, say, 2021, you'd probably go Lamaby, top order red ball batsman. Then in T20 cricket, he's sort of a low order hitter who strikes at 150, and then he bowls a bit left arm pace as well. So he seems like a sort of a bolter for all formats. And I think especially what's interesting is that, you know, he wasn't an opener till last season. He barely opened in club cricket, and he's just taken to it so naturally. But then he's played different innings with different tempos. The one against Worcester was different to the one against Essex. He kind of seems like he's just a very adaptable cricketer. So yeah, he's definitely the one to watch for me.
And you spoke to him last night.
Not last night.
No, he didn't. He spoke to me recently.
Yeah, recently, just finding a bit more about him. And yeah, I just saw the whole thing about him basically being approached to open the batting because there was no space in the middle order, and just taking to it so easily is quite remarkable, really, when we look at opening the batting in this country as probably the toughest gig there is.
Yeah,
that's what I did, you know. Made my debut batting 8 and bowling first change, and ended up because nobody else wanted to do it. So yeah, he's got a big future, that kid.
It did last summer. It did have the look of a kind of sacrificial lamb to it, didn't it? When they threw him up top, so to come through like he did was pretty impressive. But no one else scored 300s in the tournament, I think.
Tom asks, I know we've talked about a couple of them already, but best young players to watch in the county championship. He suggests James Coles and Tawanda Muyeye, who we talked about a little bit last week. Coles is the Sussex 16-year-old who debuted last season. Bowls a bit of left-arm spin, bats to the top six. So any names who we've not mentioned yet already that haven't played for England, that's the one rule. They don't have to be that young, but they can't play for England.
Well, I mean, Butch touched on it, but with Verdi, I'm interested to see how he does, especially now because of last summer, he bowled really well, but then you've got Moriarty as well, the left-arm spinner.
Rob Key's favourite player.
Exactly, and whether they can form, whether they form a spin duo or it's just one of them at the start of the season, which is most likely it's April, and just to see how he progresses because he's got an excellent red ball record. I think he's got 90-something wickets in 20-something games at a pretty low average. But I spoke to Simon Harmer last month and just asked him to pinpoint a few spinners to watch out for, and he really talked up Verdi, but also said that he didn't think he's surprised that Verdi's not kicked on as, you know, Harmer thought he would, which is interesting when he's actually done. He's got a pretty good record.
Really good.
And the other one that Harmer mentioned who he's really impressed by is Jack Carson, who's at Sussex, who's 20 years old, from Northern Ireland, and was Sussex leading wicket taker last year. And he just said that, you know, Harmer said you can either really rip it as a bowler or you can't, and Carson's got it. So he's one to watch out for, definitely, especially under Ian Salisbury there as well.
Joe?
Yeah, not necessarily that new a name, but one for me, George Garton at Sussex, who's been around for a few years now. I think he's only 23, though. You might remember he was taken to Australia as a net bowler because they wanted to basically have a left arm quick available. I think Mitchell Johnson's still fresh in their memory from the previous tour. But he was one of those bowlers. I think he was kind of fast before he was particularly good. I think his speed came before his skills. But it seems over the last few years, the skills are starting to catch up. He's also a much better batsman than he was. I think perhaps white ball cricket might be his best route into international cricket if that does indeed happen. But it'll be interesting to see. He's genuinely quick around the 90-mile hour mark. He kind of led Sussex's attack last year with Ollie Robinson on England duty for a lot of it. So it'll be interesting to see how he goes in combination with Robinson. I think that's an interesting new ball attack. I guess they'll take the new ball together. So he's one to keep an eye on, I think.
But I've got a few. Josh Tung is sort of fit again at Worcester. I mean, I know he's been on the radar. He's been on fast bowling academies and all that kind of stuff, but he's pretty exciting. Lewis Rees, who's kind of like who's Derby's sort of number one man in, you know, the all action sort of all rounder.
So he opens the batting and the bowling.
Yeah.
I was trying to think.
Proper Billy Whiz.
I was trying to think, can you think of other county cricketers in your time that have done? I mean, it's kind of like school cricket, isn't it? It's just the best player.
Well, there was, did it for Warwickshire, left armer.
Oh, Neil Carter.
In sort of played in the 40 over games, opened the batting and opened the bowling.
Cricket's pretty unusual, isn't it?
I can't think of anyone. Final thing I want to talk about the county championship is we've talked a little bit about the format already, but specifically in relation to the England test team, a lot was made of how English players might not have been as well prepared for the conditions they got in India as they could have been.
The Indian players weren't prepared for that either.
That's true.
You know, most of their guys averaged under 24 as well.
That is true. But how much do you think having so much of the season taking place before June impacts the development of English cricketers for all conditions?
Well, I interviewed Mason Crane last week, this time last year or a bit earlier, his Red Bull prospects were looking pretty bleak because Hampshire just signed Nathan Lyon, and I think Crane was a bit perhaps surprised to see that happen. I mean, this is England's, obviously played for England already, suddenly looked like he didn't have much of a Red Bull future. Lyon didn't come last year. Crane ended up having a really good Bob Willis, 14 wickets at 14, I think, and he was saying his confidence was starting to come back, and then he said almost in passing, and it was great bowling in August. And obviously, I mean, yeah, of course it is for a leg spinner, but that's not really going to happen much at all this summer. So I think it makes a huge difference. How can you stake your claim to be a leg spinner for England when you're bowling that many games in April and May?
Not bowling.
Or not bowling. And or you're watching Carl Abbott and Mohammed Abbas. He's not going to be many wickets left to take, I don't think. So I think it makes a huge difference. And having said that, I don't know what the answer is. There's just too, as we said last week, there's too much cricket.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, you've always had the issue, or you always had the idea that, you know, we should do more to prepare pitches of such and such in order to... You tour India once every 4 years or whatever it might be. Whatever you do, with the exception of perhaps cricket against Australia, whereby the cricket shouldn't be that different between here and there. Yes, bounce and pace are slightly different, but it shouldn't be that different. Preparing for specific tours is just kind of, it's a fool's game in the English game. So what you would like to have is a season whereby, you know, the seamers are on top to begin with. Batting becomes a lot more fun and joyous sort of come June, July, and then the spinners get their go towards the end. And that's, you know, the English cricket has always kind of sorted itself out along the lines that you will get differing conditions throughout the 4.5 months of the year. But we're not going to get that now. We just don't have that, because you'd miss out that big chunk of the summer in the middle. And in terms of what you can do about it, if you don't play in July and August, there's nothing you can do about it. Zero. Absolutely zip. And so what you're looking at is then being able to sending players to or sending coaches maybe even to sort of go over to Sri Lanka and India and bring back knowledge and be able to impart it to players whilst they're not actually playing, but maybe they can practice in that way back at home, as well as sending the players themselves off to go and to work on those aspects of their technique. But it's gone. Unless you play at that time of the year, and unless you have the natural occurrence of the conditions changing through the course of an English summer, there isn't anything you can do about it. And any time you try to artificially insert a certain type of conditions into the game, there are always unintended consequences to doing that. And so the best thing to do is to allow the seasons to do what they do to a natural growing surface, grass, and then have the players adapt accordingly. Do not adapt the conditions in order to force the players into a change. Allow the conditions as they are to force the players to change themselves. You see what I mean? There's a massive difference in artificially changing the game by changing the conditions than there are asking the players to adapt to the conditions that confront them. And it's so dangerous to do that. We do it all the time in English cricket. We've done it forever. You change the ball, you change the seam, you're heavy roller, no heavy roller, toss, no toss. Leave the game and allow the players to adapt to it. Don't do it the other way around, because it does not work.
Hmm. Well, specifically for batsmen, if you are playing so much of the season in April, May, where it's harder to bat, I remember Stephen Fleming said something really interesting in commentary in the winter during the New Zealand home summer. He said that when he was coming through, there wasn't a great talent pool in New Zealand cricket. So he kind of just got over-promoted throughout his whole career, even from a youngster. So he never learned the art of scoring hundreds, and that continued for him into the test game. Do you think there's a danger for young batsmen in England if it is harder to bat in the early months of the season, that they actually just don't learn the art of scoring hundreds? Is that something that you just do learn?
No, I think what happens is, I thought what used to happen would be that, again, you would have this natural idea where you were kind of looking to be very tight and very, you know, try and play for your off stump, try and leave the ball as much as you possibly could when the conditions were challenging in the early part of the season, in the knowledge that you would get the chance to bat when it was better later on. You know, it would be worth going through some of the pain and trying to hang in there and, you know, perhaps try and wear the attack down, all of those other cliches, which are cliches because they're true. Because at some point, the thing would change. You'd turn over the course of the season, you would make up the runs that you didn't make in the beginning. But if you don't have that bit in the middle where you could make up the runs in the beginning, you start to fret, you know. There's nothing wrong with the conditions being challenging early season. That's how you learn to play again, you know, for 20 overs when the ball's hooping and doing stuff in Australia. That's where you get the little inserts of batting and bowling information in your game. But if you miss out on the chunk in the middle, if you don't have that bit in the middle, you're kind of like, we're battling here, and now it's spinning square at the end. Where's the bit in the middle where I'm supposed to score my runs? You know, and that's really tough. I'm fortunate that I didn't really encounter that. The T20 season kind of, it took out part of the middle of the summer, but you were still playing the odd, you know, you'd go back to four-day cricket in the middle of it and et cetera, et cetera. You would never have this situation where you were just blank. It's just, it's white ball. It's pin the ears back and swing for the two best months of the summer. And so I have a lot of sympathy with batters and bowlers in that case. I don't think it only adversely affects one group. Look, it's no fun. I mean, we're looking out at the Oval at the moment, and it is freezing out there. The guys are all in bobble hats, and you know,
wouldn't know it from the sky, though, would you?
You would. Yeah.
It looks quite nice,
but it isn't. It's not.
Take out the temperature.
You know, you're desperately excited to get out there in the middle again, but it's a real challenge playing cricket in these conditions. It's supposed to be a warm game. That's why you stand still for most of it. Yeah. I have a lot of sympathy, and of course it will affect development in all kinds of different ways, in ways that I probably haven't even imagined, because I didn't go through. I didn't have to work out how I was going to be a cricket player whilst having sort of large chunks of the season taken away from one art and given over to another.
Mm. On a more cheery note, ahead of the start of the season, Tara, what's your moment of the week?
Well, it was sat here at the Oval on Friday watching Ollie Pope get some runs. It was freezing, but it was just nice to watch some cricket and kind of a nice reminder that we're only a few days away from the start of the season. And Pope, you know, being Pope, he looks pretty good.
Yeah, there's a photo of him wearing two shirts and three jumpers when he was in the field that day. So yeah, it was really pretty chilly. Anyway. Yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, for all the talk of dates and time of year, I would say I like this county championship format. I think there's a lot to... It's nice that some counties are playing each other that haven't played each other for years. Mm. It's nice that everyone can win it at the start. I think it's also nice that later on, there's not so much on every game that sides can experiment a little bit at the end as well, which should see some young players given a chance. The only thing I think the Bob Willis final at the end is a bit odd, I think. It's a bit much for the championship winners to then have to play a game that they might lose and therefore not sort of win the final thing of the season. Yeah. I think that doesn't quite work. I wonder if that will stay. But I do think this structure of the championship could last beyond. I mean, it's in place because of COVID, but I think it could last beyond that. I think there's quite a lot that's going for it.
Well, speaking of Bob Willis, it was kind of like it was a template that he drew up around about the turn of the century to have what do they call them? They didn't call them divisions, they were called something else. But anyway, to have, three groups of three. I think his idea was conferences. Yeah. I think his idea was more that you had to escape them. You know, you were sort of stuck in your conference and it would be 10 championship games or whatever it was. This idea I like better because you're right, it does actually give all of the counties a realistic chance of the promotion into the Division One is actually quite a good prize, I think. So what you haven't done is stripped away all of the ambition from certain counties, as you do with two divisions, as it has been. There are a lot of counties with two divisions of nine for whom promotion is kind of like you pay lip service to it at the beginning of the season, but your squad is entirely built around perhaps getting a bit of success in the one day cups, and the championship is an afterthought, or it's a developmental side or whatever it might be. But with this, it's not unrealistic for every single one to think, well, we can make it to Division One, and we get to Division One, you're in with a chance of winning the whole thing.
Was it Derbyshire? We're pretty close to getting to Bob Willis final last
right,
year.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I think allowing teams to have that ambition and dream actually then will drive them forward to up their standards in a way that two divisions of nine or the old 18 all in one never did. Mm. So I like it, and it'd be interesting to see how it goes.
Nice. Well, that's the end of the show. Thanks, Butch. Thanks, Dar. Thanks, Joe. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Thanks for joining. If you liked what you saw or listened to, hit the subscribe button, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week for the release of the Wisden Almanac. Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network.